Harper Audio presents The Map That Changed the World, William Smith and the Birth of Modern Geology, written and read by Simon Winchester. Prologue. Above one of the many grand marble staircases within the east wing of Burlington House, the great Palladian mansion on the north side of London's Piccadilly, hangs a pair of huge sky-blue velvet curtains, twisted and tasseled silk ropes beside them. Although many may wonder in passing, rarely does any one of the scores of people who climb and descend the stairs inquire as to what lies behind the drapes. A blocked-off window, perhaps? A painting too grotesque to show? A rare continental tapestry faded by the sunlight? Once in a while, someone curious and bold will demand a look, whereupon a functionary will emerge from behind a door marked private, and with practiced hand will tug gently on the silk ropes. The curtains will slowly part, revealing an enormous and magnificent map of England and Wales, engraved and coloured in sea blue, green, bright yellow, orange, umber, in a beguiling and unfamiliar mixture of lines, patches, and stippled shapes. The German Ocean, it says to the east of the English coast instead of today's North Sea. There is, in an inset, a small cross-section of what is said to be the underside of the country from Wales to the River Thames. Otherwise, all is readily familiar, comfortingly recognisable. The document is exquisitely beautiful, a beauty set off by its great size, more than 8 feet by 6, and the fact that it towers, looms indeed, above those who stand on the staircase to see it. The care and attention to its detail is clear. This is the work of a craftsman, lovingly done, the culmination of years of study, months of careful labour. At the top right is its description, engraved in copperplate flourishes. A delineation of the strata of England and Wales with part of Scotland, exhibiting the collieries and mines, the marshes and fenlands originally overflowed by the sea, and the varieties of soil according to the variations in the substrata, illustrated by the most descriptive names. There's a signature by W. Smith. There's a date, August 1, 1815. This, the official will explain, is the first true geological map of anywhere in the world. It's a map that heralded the beginning of a whole new science. It's a document that laid the groundwork for the making of great fortunes in oil, in iron, in coal, and in other countries in diamonds, tin, platinum, and gold and silver that were won by explorers who used such maps. It's a map that laid the foundations of a field of study that culminated in the work of Charles Darwin. It's a map whose making signified the beginnings of an era not yet over that has been marked ever since by the excitement and astonishment of scientific discoveries that allowed human beings to start at last to stagger out from the fogs of religious dogma and to come to understand something certain about their own origins and those of the planet they inhabit. It's a map that had an importance, symbolic and real, for the development of one of the great fundamental fields of study, geology, which, arguably like physics and mathematics, is a field of learning and endeavour that underpins all knowledge, all understanding. The map is in many ways a classic representation of the ambitions of its day. It was, like so many other grand projects that survive as testament to their times, the Oxford English Dictionary, the Grand Triangulation of India, the Manhattan Project, the Concord, the Human Genome, a project of almost unimaginably vast scope that required great vision, energy, patience, and commitment to complete. But a signal difference sets this map apart. Each of the other projects, grand in scale, formidable in execution, and unassailable in historical importance, required the labour of thousands. The OED needed entire armies of volunteers. To build the Concord demanded the participation of 2 entire governments. More men died during the Indian triangulation than in scores of modest wars. The offices at Los Alamos may have housed behind their chain-link fences shadowy figures who would turn out to be Nobel laureates or spies, but they were all hemmed in by immense battalions of physicists. And to attend to all their various needs, be they bomb makers, plane builders, lexicographers, codifiers of chemistry, or measurers of land, there were legions upon legions of minions, runners, amanuenses, and drones. The incomparably beautiful geological map of 1815, however, required none of these. As vital as it turned out to be for the future of humankind, it stands apart, because it was conceived, imagined, begun, undertaken, and continued and completed against all odds by just one man. All the Herculean labours involved in the mapping of the imagined underside of an entire country were accomplished not by an army or a legion or a committee or a team, but by the single individual who finally put his signature to the completed document, William Smith, then 46 years old, the orphaned son of the village blacksmith from the unsung hamlet of Churchill in Oxfordshire. And yet William Smith, who created this great map in solitary endeavour, and from whose work all manner of benefits, commercial, intellectual, and nationalistic, then flowed, was truly at first a prophet without honour. Smith had little enough going for him. He was of simple yeoman stock, more or less self-taught, stubborn and visionary, highly motivated and single-minded. Although he had to suffer the most horrendous frustrations during the long making of the map, he never once gave up or even thought of doing so. And yet, very soon after the map was made, he became ruined completely. He was forced to leave London, where he had drawn and finished the map, and which he considered his home. All that he owned was confiscated. He was compelled to live as a homeless man for years, utterly without recognition. His life was wretched. His wife went mad, nymphomania being but one of her recorded symptoms. He fell ill. He had few friends, and his work seemed to him to have been without point, without merit. Ironically and cruelly, part of the reason for his humiliation lies behind another set of faded velvet curtains that hang nearby on another of Burlington House's many elaborate staircases. There, it turns out, is quite another map, made and published shortly after William Smith's. It was, in all essentials, a copy, made by rivals, and it was made, if not expressly, then at least in part, with the intention of ruining the reputation of this great and unsung pioneer from Oxfordshire, a man who was not gently born, and who was therefore compelled, like so many others in those times, to bear the ungenerous consequences of his class. But in the very long run, William Smith was fortunate. A long while after the map had been published, a kindly and liberal-minded nobleman for whom Smith had been performing tasks on his estate in a small village in Yorkshire recognised him, knew somehow that this was the man who had created the extraordinary and beautiful map about which it was said all learned England and all the world of science outside was talking. This aristocratic figure let people, influential and connected people, know about the man he had discovered. He reported back that he was hidden, incognito, in the depths of the English countryside. He supposedly had no expectation that anyone would now ever remember or would ever recognise the solitary masterpiece that he had once made. He imagined he was doomed to suffer an undeserved oblivion. But on this occasion his pessimism was misplaced. The messages that had been sent did get through, with the consequence that eventually William Smith was persuaded to return to London to receive at last the honours and rewards that were due to him, and to be acknowledged as the founding father of the whole new science of English geology, a science that remains at the core of intellectual endeavour to this day. It is now exactly 200 years since William Smith began work on the map that changed the world. What follows, drawn from his diaries and his letters, is a portrait of both a long-forgotten man and the world in which he lived and worked, as well as the story of his great map, which has remained hidden behind the blue velvet curtains of a great house in London for far too long. Escape on the Northbound Stage. The last day of August, 1819, a Tuesday, dawned grey, showery, and refreshingly cool in London, promising a welcome end to a week-long spell of close and muggy weather that seemed to have put all the capital's citizens in a nettlesome, liverish mood. Anyone trying to hurry along the cobbled and granite-paved streets that day was still certain to be frustrated despite the improvement in the weather. The crowds, the crush, the dirt, the smell. More than 1 million people had lately been counted as living within and beyond London city walls, and each day hundreds more, the morning papers reported, were to be found streaming in from the countryside, bent on joining the new prosperity that all hoped might soon be flowering now that the European wars were over. the city's population was well on the way to doubling itself in less than 20 years. The streets were in consequence filled with a jostling, pullulating, dawdling mass of people. And animals, too. It seemed of little matter to some farmers that there had long been laws to keep them from driving cattle through the centre of town, so among the throngs of people one could spot mangy-looking sheep, more than a few head of cattle, the odd black pig, and, of course, horses, countless horses, pulling carriages and goods vehicles alike. The stench of their leavings on a hot week such as this had been was barely tolerable. Since it was very early in the morning, there were, of course, fewer crowds than usual. Fewer, that is, except in one or two more notorious spots, where a sad and shabby ritual of the dawn tended to bring out the throngs, and where this story is most appropriately introduced. The better known of the London sites where the morning masses gathered was in the rabbit warren of lanes that lay near St. Paul's Cathedral, to the east of where the River Fleet had once run. Halfway along the Fleet Market, a passer-by would have noted, perhaps with the wry amusement of the metropolitan sophisticate, that crowds had gathered outside a rather noble, high-walled building, whose address, according to a written inscription above the tall gateway, was simple, Number 9. An onlooker would have been amused because the address was a mere euphemism, the building's real purpose only too well known. The streets to the west of St. Paul's were one of the two districts of 19th-century London where a clutch of the capital's many prisons were concentrated. The Newgate, the Bridewell, the Coldbath Fields, and the Ludgate jails had all been built nearby, in what in winter were the chill gloom and coal-smoke fogs of the River Valley. And Number 9 was the site of the best-known of them all, the Prince of Prisons, the Fleet. There was another precisely similar ghetto of jails on the south side of the Thames, in that area that, then technically beyond London, was the borough of Southwark. Another small huddle of grim, high-walled mansion houses of punishment and restraint, the Clink, the Marshalsea, the Bedlam Prison Hospital, and formidable in appearance and reputation, just like its sister establishment back up at Number 9, the infamous, barracks-like monstrosity of the Prison of the King's Bench. The King's Bench, the nearby Marshalsea and the Fleet, were different from most London prisons, however. They were very old, for a start, and they were privately run, according to a set of very strange rituals. They had been instituted for a sole purpose, the holding, for as long as necessary, of men and women who could not or would not pay their bills. These three institutions were debtors' prisons, and the reason that crowds formed around their entrances each sunrise is that, every morning, just after dawn, it was the policy of their wardens to free those inmates who had discharged their obligations. Of the three, the Fleet had the most intriguing entranceway. On either side of the gate was a caged window, and above it the motto, "Remember the poor debtors, having no allowance." Through the grate could be seen a small and gloomy chamber, with nothing inside except a wooden bench. A doorway beyond, locked and barred from the outside, gave access to the main cell block. Each day a new, impoverished prisoner would be pushed out into the cage to spend the next 24 hours on begging duty, pleading with passers-by for money to help in his or her plight. Debtors were obliged to pay for their time in prison. Those who turned out to be totally out of funds were forced to go into the grated room and beg. The crowds outside the Fleet and the King's Bench prisons on that cool August Tuesday morning, and that so interrupted the progress of men of affairs on their way along the granite setts with which the roads in Southwark and St. Paul's had recently been paved, were there to see a spectacle. Tourists came to the jails to see the beggars. The merely curious, as well as the small press of family and friends, and perhaps some still unsatisfied creditors, came to greet with amiable good cheer a small group of inmates who each day would emerge blinking into the morning sunlight. According to the prison records, one of the half-dozen prisoners who stepped free from behind the high walls of the King's Bench prison on that Tuesday morning was a sturdy-looking yeoman whose papers showed him to have come from Oxfordshire, 60 miles to the west of London. Those few portraits painted of him in his later years, together with a single silhouette fashioned when he was in his dotage, and a bust sculpted in marble more than 20 years later, show him to be a somewhat thick-set man, balding, with a weather-beaten face. Some less charitable souls might call him rather plain-looking, even in truth a little ugly. His forehead slants backward, a trifle alarmingly. His nose is somewhat too large for comfort. His mutton-chop whiskers are wayward. But in most of the pictures he seems to be wearing an expression that serves by way of compensation for the facial shortcomings. He seems, from his looks, at once tolerant, kindly, perhaps even vaguely amused by the droll complexities of his life. At the time of his release from jail he was 50 years old, and he must have emerged from the main gate into the Southwark crowds that day in an embarrassed and fretful state. He had good reason to be anxious. The previous 4 years of his life had been trying, racked by debt and uncertainty, by privation and public humiliation. And, as he was soon about to learn, only a matter of hours after his release, his trials were far from over. The address of his lodgings was given in Bankruptcy Court as No. 15 Buckingham Street, and it was to this imposing stone mansion in which he had lived for the previous 14 years that he now walked alone. He had spent the better part of the last 10 weeks in the miseries behind the bars of the King's Bench, living for most of that time in a crowded cell, a chummage, with 2 or 3 others similarly ruined. Now he had his freedom and the pleasure of his own company. He quickened his pace. He was a staggeringly fast walker as he strode steadily westwards to his house. It was a short enough walk. He had his choice of bridges across the River Thames, and had only to turn left when he had made it over the fetid and polluted river with its muddily inelegant banks. He walked steadily along the entire length of the Strand, newly outfitted with the cast-iron lamps of the Gaslight and Coke Company, and past familiar churches, shops, tailors, and alehouses. The streets here, by now some distance from the prisons, pulsated with all the elegance and gaiety of Regency times. This, after all, was the day of Beau Brummel, though Brummel himself had only 3 years before left London for France, preparing for his own date with the debtor's prison and his subsequent death in a French lunatic asylum. The London streets that morning would have been crowded with the dandies who, their newly invented umbrellas sheltering them from the showers, followed the strict particulars of his style. The entire stretch along which the glum but relieved Oxfordshire convict walked spoke all too gaudily of money and amusement and brio, a sharp contrast, no doubt, to the grim mood of the man who passed among them. In ordinary circumstances he might have stopped at No. 181 the Strand, the elegant bow-windowed building where his best friend, the noted cartographer John Carey, had his offices. But this particular morning he was in a hurry and eager to move on. It took him 10 minutes to pass the entire length of the Strand, after which he turned left. Trafalgar Square had not yet been built to act as a landmark, and turned into that small maze of fashionable Georgian neoclassical houses that had been put up by the 4 Adam brothers half a century before, and that they had named after Adelphoi, the Greek word for brothers, the Adelphi. Down he strode, past the Savoy, along John Adam Street itself, and finally into Buckingham Street, and up to the front door of No. 15. But the door to his house, he was shocked to find, was shut and bolted. A tipstaff stood outside on sentry duty, and there was a notice pinned to the woodwork. The landlords had repossessed the house and had emptied it of much of its furnishings and papers. Work was still going on. The officer was on hand to ensure that no one, and in particular this one man, attempted to gain entry. To make doubly certain, the bailiff asked for the man's name. "William Smith," the arrival replied. There was an expression of mumbled regret, and the burly sentry took up a stance with his arms folded in front of him, brooking no argument. No, he could not come in. William Smith, beaten down yet again, but now determined not to suffer the indignity of confrontation, turned away. There was a particularly cruel and desperate irony in this situation. On the following morning, the Wednesday, the same John Carey, at whose offices Smith might well have chosen to call, was due to publish in book form the second part of a formidable new collection of geological maps, the latest volume of what was coming to be recognised as one of the most profoundly important books ever made. Carey's great new Geological Atlas of England and Wales had been begun 4 years ago, when the cartographer and his apprentice son George had laboured mightily to issue a work that was as scientifically epical as it was physically majestic, the finely engraved, hand-coloured map, the 8.5 feet high by 6 feet wide triumph of cartographic brilliance that was formerly called a delineation of the strata of England and Wales with a part of Scotland, but that has been known ever since as the first large-scale national geological map in the world. It was a document that was to change the face of a science, indeed to create a whole new science, to set in train a series of scientific movements that would lead eventually to the inquiries of Charles Darwin, to the birth of evolutionary theory, and to the burgeoning of an entirely new way for human beings to view their world and their universe. The inevitable collision between the new, rationally based world of science and the old ecclesiastical, faith-directed world of belief was about to occur, and in the vanguard of the new movement, both symbolically and actually, was this great new map, and now this equally enormous atlas that John Kerry of the Strand was about to publish, and the revolutionary thinking that lay behind their making. Both works were the creations of William Smith, the yeoman from Oxfordshire who, on thus the very eve of publication, was now being turned away from the marble steps in front of the house in which he had lived and worked for so long. And yet, however much of an embarrassment this must have been, the situation was not wholly unfamiliar to him. For although William Smith's years of careful observation and his wholly innovative ways of thinking were about to alter the course of scientific inquiry for ever, he had at the same time been forced to wage what must have seemed a ceaseless war against his own humiliation and ill fortune. He had been forced to waste his energies raging against the cheating and class discrimination that seemed time and again to frustrate him. And here he was now, without a home, without possessions, without any evident future, and yet with his new book, his new great work of science, his masterpiece of craftsmanship and endeavour, about to be offered to the public once again and on the very next day. His situation must have seemed grim indeed, and the brutality of coincidence can hardly have escaped him. Precisely how William Smith reacted during the rest of that wretched day goes unrecorded. It'd be tempting to suppose that he marched swiftly back up to John Kerry's office that very afternoon and borrowed money, taking an advance against the sale of his atlas, which would be published the following morning. All that is known, however, is that he decided there and then that he'd turn his back on the London that in his view had so contributed to his ruin. So he found and collected his wife. He found and collected the nephew, who also then lived with them. And he gathered together what few possessions the two of them, in being turned with evident haste out of the Adelphi House a few days before, had managed to save for him. He made his way across the crowded capital to the Black Swan Inn at Holborn, which was known as the principal stagecoach terminal for travellers making their way to Edinburgh via the Great North Road. During the summer, there was a northbound coach every other day, and if he was lucky, he might even on that same night have won 3 seats and have been thundering northward in a rocking carriage behind the 4 great fire-breathing horses of the Northern Mail. His driver would carry him and his fellow passengers maybe 60 miles a day, and so the following morning would see him at Peterborough, the next day at Stamford, then Grantham. Finally, after 4 days, the coach reached the small Yorkshire post-town of Northallerton, and this is where, bone-weary and hungry, William Smith finally got down and began the process, much like any other itinerant tradesman or journeyman, of looking for custom and for work. "The man might be imprisoned, but his discoveries could not be," he was to write some years later. "London quitted with disgust, the cheering fields regained." It was to be 12 years before William Smith returned to spend much time in London. The man who was now hurtling and banging his way northward on that summer evening stagecoach was then at the low point of his life, a life that, when recounted in as full a manner as the evidence allows, turns out to have been more honourable, more deservedly honoured, and on a world scale much more important than he at that moment could ever have imagined. A Land Awakening from Sleep. William Smith was born into a world of dogma, faith, and certainty. into a conservative English society that his own discoveries and theories would one day help shake to its very foundations. And yet already, however conservative the mood of the early 18th century may have seemed, there are signs that, viewed from today's perspective, suggest that even at the time of his birth, it was imperceptibly readying itself for all that discoverers like Smith would find and do. In countless ways, both great and small, the faiths and certainties of centuries past were being edged aside, and the world was being prepared, if gently and unknowingly, to receive the shocking news of scientific revelation. Not that any of the vague subtleties of coming change had reached very far. William Smith was born, the first son of the local blacksmith in the hamlet of Churchill in Oxfordshire, on March the 23rd, 1769. It was a measure of the rigour and certitude of both the place and the times that there could be great canonical precision about such a moment. To religious folk, and most English country folk of the time were religious, their daily rhythms set by the steeple bell, their manners regulated from the parsonage, the event that gave a first-born child to John and Anne Smith, in their cottage on the edge of the green in Churchill, took place, according to their implacably held beliefs, exactly 5,772 years, 4 months and 16 days after the creation of the world. Any contemporary student of the Bible could have been quite certain about this figure. In fact, he or she could have been quite certain as to the very number of hours since the creation, had the Churchill midwife been scrupulous enough to note the time of the infant's birth. A quick calculation could be made on the basis of an almost unchallenged belief about human origins that was then held by most men and women who lived deep in the English shires, the notion that the world had been brought swiftly into existence exactly 4,004 years before the birth of Christ. Lest anyone forget, all the Bibles that were in use at the time had dates printed in bold scarlet letters in the left-hand margins, annotations to the verses of the Old Testament designed to act as a gentle reminder. In the beginning God had the number 4004 BC written beside it. The text of the Holy Scripture's subsequent dramas, from Cain and Abel onward, had progressively lower and lower red-printed figures in the margin, until the events in the manger at Bethlehem, by which time the figure had been cycled down, of course, to zero. The dating of the Bible was very much an idea of the later Middle Ages. It had taken decades for anyone to come up with credible numbers. In an effort to do so, scores of scholarly zealots had carefully analysed the basic biblical idea, which had never after all volunteered an age for the earth, merely the manner in which it had come about, by sedulously counting the number of human generations they believed to have come and gone between the making of Adam and the begetting of Christ. On the basis of their workings, it was reckoned at the close of the 16th century that the world was, give or take, 6,000 years old. It was left to a genial Irish prelate named James Usher, while he was the Bishop of Armagh, to fix the date with absolute precision. According to his workings, which he managed to convince his clerical colleagues were impeccably accurate, God had created the world and all its creatures in one swift and uninterrupted process of divine mechanics that began on the dot of the all-too-decent hour of 9 a.m. on a Monday, October the 23rd, 4004 B.C. The cynical and the sceptical may need some reminding of the fine print, of just what was preached in the church in which William Smith was baptised, of the kind of firm beliefs with which his community was invested. Whatever interest Smith the man might later develop in fossils, geology, and the makings of humankind, at the time he was born there was no question. The entire process of creation had taken God the familiar 6 days, and he had begun it 5,772 years before. At the start of that late October week, in the year that a modern Christian calendar would style 4004 BC, the deity organised the basic concepts of light and dark, sun and moon, wet and dry. He then made every ocean, inlet, river, sandbar, meadow, desert, mountain, ice cap, and fjord. The structure of the world, its topography, and the geology that forms the core of this story were complete. By the morning of the 26th, the Thursday, God had seen to it that life had been begun, and by that evening every first microbe, newt, spider, serpent, eagle, cat, horse, and monkey had been duly set in place to creep, crawl, swim, fly, leap, spring, and deploy its opposable thumb to climb. By the following day the botanical phyla were all in place. Every rainforest, grassland, savanna, peony, orchid, rose, palm, apple, pine, and daisy had been left on earth contentedly to bloom. All of Milton's rocks, caves, lakes, fens, bogs, dens were now fully accumulated. An earthly paradise was set, ready to be lost. And then, by the Saturday, most important of all, emerged those creatures who would lose it. The first two examples of human, in the bipedal and upright, but otherwise subtly different from each other forms of Adam and Eve, had been created in the Garden of Eden. They were at this stage blissfully unaware, of course, and therefore untroubled by the fall, which would come later via the agency of the already created serpent and apple. Recorded history could now formally begin. Human beings were in place, made in the image of their Maker, and they could do with their world more or less as they and their Maker between them pleased. Thus was it all done. Come midnight on the Saturday, with all this frantic labour accomplished, the weary divinity slept, having declared that all he had created was good, and fully ready to begin the adventuring he had ordained for it for the next 6,000 years and more. Yet, when William Smith was born, the unquestioning acceptance of a notion such as this was beginning to change. There were vague stirrings of enlightenment from among the nation's chattering classes. Some cynical views, in law criminally heretical views, that wafted up from the fashionable salons and drawing-rooms of London, challenged the very likelihood of divine creation. Among them was a new notion, still curious and outrageous to most in the 18th century, that Earth might in fact be a very good deal older than the human race that inhabited it, such that humankind and its planet might not in fact have been of near simultaneous origin. There was no evidence whatsoever for such views. Those who doubted creation were indulging in little more than inspired hunches. In later years the hunches became more certain, and indeed it would be William Smith's discoveries that would go some long way towards confirming them. But at the time he was born they were very much the idle speculation of a tiny group of sophisticates in London, and the capital was a very long way from northwest Oxfordshire, both in distance and in temper. The muddy and rutted roads that passed across the ridges of the Chiltern Hills between Oxford and London did much to keep at bay any such wild and disagreeable ideas as these. Where Smith was born, among that small muddle of warm-coloured stone cottages, with thatched roofs and climbing roses, the village green and the inn and the duck pond and the old steepled parish church, beliefs about such weighty matters as humankind's beginning were unburdened by the complications of too much thought. They were taken on faith as the revelations of Scripture, and when and if they were recounted, they were larded with appropriate and long-remembered quotations from the book of Genesis. The infant Smith, whose father and mother were an essentially unremarkable country couple, was thus born into a world of which at least the basis of existence had a certainty. The origins of the planet, just like the origins of mankind, were assumed to be fixed, uncomplicated, and divinely directed. But all such assumptions were to be assaulted, and shockingly so, before the next 100 years were out. To no small degree it was to be William Smith's geological findings, along with a raft of other discoveries, that were to change things. His findings were to prove vitally important in triggering the collision that was eventually to take place between the religious beliefs that were in the ascendant at the time and the scientific reasoning that would provide the spur for the intellectual activities of a century later. Science was the key, along with the scientific method, with all its underpinnings of observation, deduction, and rational thought. The consequence, once the theories of Charles Darwin in particular had begun to sink in, was a profound modification of the way in which people thought of nature, of society, and of themselves, which makes it all the more appropriate, given the impact his ideas would have, that it was into a time of suddenly accelerating scientific achievement and technological application that William Smith was born. For, at the very moment that he was born, things were changing, and changing fast. In the year of his birth, which, according to parish records at Churchill, was 1769, there were, for example, three developments, nicely coincident, that in retrospect suggest all too powerfully the change that was in the wind. As indeed it was, for the first time in British history the word industry was no longer being used simply to describe the nobility of human labour, and had come instead to mean what it does today, the systematic and organised use of that labour, generally with the assistance of mechanical devices and machines, to create what would thenceforth be called manufactured goods. The Industrial Revolution, in short, was at hand, and three creations from Smith's birth year are well worth noting here, since they more than anything suggest the temper of the times. As it happened, for instance, 1769 was the year of the grant of patent for James Watt's first condensing steam engine, perhaps the most important invention of the entire era. Josiah Wedgwood, who had been busily making fine pottery in Staffordshire for some years past, opened his great factory, known as Etruria, near Hanley, also in 1769. And the great field of textile-making, which was being steadily revolutionised by a cannonade of new inventions, was most notably advanced by the creations of Richard Arkwright, who made the first water-powered cotton spinning frame, also in 1769. Watt, Wedgwood and Arkwright, a holy trinity from the brave new world that was coming into being, were now unknowingly ushering in the man who would change the view of that world for all time. In all corners of the industrial world there was change, development, innovation, the shock of the new. Coal, iron, ships, pottery, cloth, steam, these were the mantras of the moment. The great English ironmasters, for example, were approaching their zenith. Cranage, Smeaton and Cort were developing the processes for puddling iron and rolling molten metal. Abraham Darby and John Wilkinson were constructing the first iron bridges in the world. Wilkinson, unarguably the greatest of all 18th-century champions of things ferrous, was making the first mine railway in 1767, then the first iron chapel for a congregation of Wesleyans, and was using iron lighters to shift coal to his three furnaces, and to cap it all, he had himself buried in 1808 in an iron coffin. Iron production was on the way to doubling every 20 years when Smith was born, and coal was too, and, in what would prove of the utmost significance to William Smith by the time he was a grown man, the mania for canal building to provide a means of transporting all the coal and iron and finished goods was teetering at its beginnings. If there were hints of a coming change in the long-held systems of belief, if the industrial world was accelerating out of all imagination, then so also, and as an obvious corollary, social change was underway as well. And when William Smith was born, the rate and scale of alteration to society was such that even those in so small and isolated a settlement as Churchill, Oxfordshire, would be bound to notice. Parliament, for example, was in the last decades of the 18th century passing enclosure acts at the rate of one a week. The formerly common-held land was now gradually being fenced and hedged, and farmed in a way, with the use of new machines and according to the principles of crop rotation, that led to the creation of the English countryside that we still see today, mannered, orderly, and inordinately pretty. The village of Churchill itself was still unenclosed in 1769. The local farmers worked the fields, as most of England had for centuries, taking for themselves alternating strips of the common-held land, and on each strip growing crops, or setting each to pasture, or leaving each fallow, as individual mood and season suggested. This method was woefully inefficient, the landscape it created plain and uninteresting. But then, in 1787, under the usual pressure from the local squirearchy and the more powerful farmers, an Enclosure Act was passed for both the village of Churchill and its surrounding countryside. Gone within a year were the ragged strips of new ploughed land and the mean acres of woods. The gently dipping fields and meadows that are still to be seen today were all hedged and ditched and ha-ha'd into existence when Smith was still a youngster. It was a development that had profound importance for the English farmer and the English countryside. It was also to be of profound importance for the beginning of the career and inspiration for the young William Smith. There was more to the farming revolution than the fashioning of a handsome landscape. To add lustre to the newly made meadows, there came new breeds of cattle and sheep, Hereford cows, Southdown sheep among them, that started to be introduced in the late 18th century, with the animals at last approximating in appearance, fatter, sturdier, and healthier than their bony and goat-like forebears, the look of the breeds to be seen today. Well-to-do farmers were so proud of their new beasts that they had paintings of them commissioned, and by doing so they founded an entirely new artistic school of domestic animal portraiture. Farming methods improved at a staggering rate, and in consequence the output of grain and potatoes and meat rose hugely. White bread became a commonplace in the diet of rich and poor. Cheese became hugely popular. An abundance of cattle feed all year round meant that at long last the winter ritual of eating only salted beef, the cattle hitherto had all died in the first cold snap for want of feed, could now be ended. A joint of roast beef promptly became the central feature of the national dinner table, part of England's national mystique, and of course the Englishman's French nickname, le roast beef. And this all led to something else. In fact, it was during the late 18th century, most probably for the first time, that society suddenly seemed to realise it had become a vastly complicated entity, its characteristics linking and interconnecting with one another in wholly unexpected ways. Such domino effects first became apparent when it was revealed, at the turn of the century, that Britain could no longer feed herself. The consumption of white bread and roast beef, for example, led indirectly to a set of completely unanticipated consequences. Although the nation's farmers certainly produced a lot, being armed with such weapons as the crop-sowing inventions of Jethro Tull and the revolutionary land management methods of Thomas Coke, all the benefits of enclosure, and although what they produced, like the bread and the meat, was a delight to eat, it became an unfortunate reality that, from that moment on until today, they couldn't produce enough. England became, during this period, and for the first time, a net importer of wheat and corn. This was due to the simplest of Malthusian reasons, the fact that the country's population had begun to rise significantly since mid-century. But the figures had begun to inch up not because of an increase in birth rate going hand in hand with the rising prosperity, but mainly because of a small but important fall in the nation's death rate. And that was due in no small part to the better diet of white bread and roast beef, an unexpected interplay of factors indeed, all part of the making of Britain as a modern, complicated society, a society readying itself for modern, complicated ideas. There were other factors in play as well. Health was improving, for example. A child like young William Smith could be more assured than ever before of survival. There was better midwifery, a relative abundance of doctors, the construction of lying-in hospitals for women in labour, the introduction, after 1760, of smallpox inoculations, the widespread opening of dispensaries, and a general agreement that fresh air was good for one and that hygiene and ventilation should be regulated. All such developments, all occurring in the latter half of the 18th century, helping to ensure that childbirth was far less risky an adventure than before. Moreover, people simply knew much more than before as well. Their lives were more efficient and comfortable than they'd ever been. There was ample reason for a new degree of physical contentment, an atmosphere that, for those who were so predisposed, was highly conducive to study, to pondering and wondering. There had been steady improvements in education and literacy. Samuel Johnson's great dictionary had been published in 1755, for example. There was now a mature newspaper industry. The postal system was becoming reliable and even efficient. A letter mailed in London could reach Chipping Norton, which was close to Churchill, the afternoon of the following day, on every day except Monday, meaning that people, even in so remote a part of the country as Oxfordshire, could now keep abreast of national developments, could tap into an ever-running wellspring of advice and information. they could learn, and by comparison with what had gone before, they could learn in double-quick time something of the trivia of trends, as when, for instance, 18th-century gentlemen farmers were beginning to buy pianos for their newly carpeted living rooms. They could know how a Mr. Chippendale began to turn out enchanting new styles of furniture from a new wood, mahogany, which had just been discovered in South America. They could read how ladies in Liverpool, Manchester, and Edinburgh were starting to supplement their inelegant skirt pockets by carrying with them what they would call indispensables, which would later be called handbags. People in Churchill knew that young ladies of fashion, reading the new coloured style journals, were now preferring to sport interestingly pale faces instead of the sunburned cheeks of the peasantry. The women of Churchill could learn all too rapidly how, in part to achieve this look, the recently invented parasols and umbrellas were becoming quite the thing. And they could also learn of foreign developments, the rising agitation in the Americas being the most vexing, or of the minutiae of their own national government. George III, the capricious and unstable farmer king who had assumed the throne in 1760, oversaw no fewer than 7 governments during just the first decade of his reign. The population now could and did display its anger and its pleasure at matters of which it came to know. The people could rant against unfairnesses, the naval press gang, say, which was still much in operation in the port cities. They could cheer and argue over the spread of civil rights. John Wilkes, the friend of liberty, was a prisoner in the Tower when Smith was born. Thomas Paine was marshalling the ideas that would eventually lead him to write The Age of Reason. Edmund Burke was well into his career as the foremost liberal thinker of his time. By 1781, by which time William Smith was a 12-year-old boy, Samuel Johnson was calling the English a nation of readers. Few were the major towns that didn't have a library. Few were the shop signs in the streets that didn't show the name of the merchant instead of merely a picture of what he sold. It was assumed, and with reason, that sufficient numbers of passers-by would now have no difficulty reading the words on the boards, something that preceding generations, and many still on the continent, would have found a considerable challenge. No matter the outcry that allowing the working classes to become educated was to debauch them and tempt them to abandon the manual labours for which they were best suited. 19 in 20 of the species were designed by nature for trade and manufacture, said a writer in the Grub Street Journal at the time of Smith's birth. To take them off to read books is the way to do them harm, to make them not wiser or better, but impertinent, troublesome, and factious. That kind of thinking was rapidly to become outmoded during the years when Smith was growing up. Whatever the political outcome, whatever the effect of the new phenomenon of public opinion, which literacy, communication, and newspapers and libraries all encouraged, the nation, save for its most reactionary element, seemed generally prepared to come to terms with the new mood for change. William Smith's formative years unrolled through a period that was both astonishingly vibrant and deeply challenging. Advances were firmly underway in almost all applied areas of science and philosophy, and in social change and artistic endeavour as well. But there was still a terrible hesitation about humans' understanding of the most fundamental questions of why they were where they were, who had placed them there, what was the point, what were their origins, what was their fate. The hesitation was deep-rooted. It stemmed, at least in part, from the frank reluctance of 18th-century men and women to accept that there even was a need to know and wonder at such things, to inquire with true rigour into matters that lay at the heart and soul of his and all society's beliefs, smacked indisputably of heresy. Even by the time that young William Smith was starting to take advantage of the world's new and inquiring mood, there was still the wide acceptance, not yet contradicted by any evidence that seemed to matter, that God had created both human beings and all the world in which they lived. That was that. No more was needed to be said. And yet, a very few bold and more radically inclined thinkers, Joseph Priestley, one of the discoverers of oxygen, and Erasmus Darwin, Charles's grandfather among them, were beginning, in these same extraordinary years, to take a more muscular and sceptical approach to the received wisdom of the Church. By the time Smith was coming to his maturity, questions about these fundamentals were being asked by more than the mere metropolitan sophisticates. The hunch that God might not have done precisely as Bishop Usher had suggested, or during the time he calculated at least, was beginning to be tested by real thinkers, by rationalists, by radically inclined scientists who were bold enough to challenge both the dogma and the law, the clerics and the courts. There was in those early days much more questioning than there was answering. It was a period more marked by bewilderment than by certainty. While most still believed that the scriptures could comfortably provide answers to all the questions about earthly origin and human purpose, there was a growing and more frequently admitted sense of puzzlement as well. A puzzlement that seems to have been most keenly felt among those scientists and engineers who were observing the natural laws of physics and chemistry, who were working with steam or fashioning iron, or digging cuts through cliffs. Among those, and others who knew something of the newly formulated laws of science, there was a new mood of questioning that hinted that maybe, just maybe, the old beliefs, rooted in the blind acceptance of churchly teachings, might not have been wholly true. A febrile fluttering of questioning thus began about what exactly was the world. How had it, and all that was in it, really come about? Was it a sacrilege to wonder at such a thing? Was it blasphemy, really blasphemy, to ask? Would lightning strike down anyone who questioned the likelihood of James Usher's numbers being correct? Would plague and boils really tear at the vitals of anyone who asked out loud just what story might it be that lay buried in the stones beneath our feet? And all this questioning tended to coalesce around one new and barely structured field of study and fascination. Could it perhaps be that geology, the frail and stripling science that had first been established to inquire into the nature of the earth before and after the deluge, could it be that geological inquiry might hold the answer? This was a science that, after all, had at least the potential, if it could be divorced from churchly dogma, to at least define and then ask the questions to which answers now seemed so urgently needed. At the time of Smith's birth, geology and those few men who called themselves geologists saw it as no part of their duties to inquire more fully, to delve more deeply into what were still seen as the realms of the divine. And yet some scientists were beginning to wonder if geology really was to be confined like this, if it was obliged to function only within the framework of faith and not to challenge it one whit. Then was it truly worthy of being called a science at all? Maybe, just maybe, it could rehabilitate itself. Maybe geology was the one new scientific discipline that, if applied courageously, might be able to help answer the fundamental and unasked questions that were beginning to trouble those tentative, nervous questioners. Perhaps geology could be the key for those who, in the enlightened, wondering spirit of the times, were at last beginning to tap their fingertips on the stout door of received belief. Many Europeans who found themselves in England in the closing decades of the 18th century talked of seeing a country waking itself from sleep. Many in England agreed, and they wondered out loud, could it be that in shaking and worrying and waking from its sleep the very land itself, by asking at last what exactly was that land and how it had first come into being, could it be that by doing this they might answer questions that would help lay bare the very core of knowledge? That was what a few men were at the time beginning to wonder. In turn, the wonderment of some of them, a country surveyor here, an Oxford-educated priest there, a fossil-collecting dilettante in this city, a radical-minded landlord in that, would be passed down to the intelligent and inquiring young Oxfordshire lad, who would before long help lay the foundations for a brand new science that would inquire quite fearlessly and eventually scandalously into the foundations of just about everything. William Smith appeared on the stage at a profoundly interesting moment. He was about to make it even more so. The Mystery of the Chedworth Bun. William Smith's introduction to the curious magic of geology, at a time when it was still a calling more nestled in myth and mystery than in the rigours of scientific discipline, came about in the most prosaic of ways. It was presaged by a domestic tragedy. When William was just 8 years old, his father John suddenly died. He had been something of a skilled mechanic as well as the village blacksmith, and he had caught a chill while working outdoors repairing a piece of farm machinery. It was a devastating blow, financially as well as emotionally. For the next couple of years, until Anne Smith married again, the boy, along with his two brothers, Daniel and John, and a sister, Elizabeth, was largely brought up by his uncle, who confusingly was called William too, who also farmed locally. A romantic might well say that William Smith was almost an orphan. To all intents and purposes, with a father dead and a mother apparently more interested in her new husband than in her child, he was. Life on his uncle's farm, however, doesn't appear to have struck him as displeasing. And in any case, the farm was itself soon to become symbolically very important in his story, principally because it was substantial enough an establishment to include a dairy. It was customary in the farms of this part of Oxfordshire for the dairymaid, who operated the butter scales, in this case William's aunt, to use as a pound weight not an artificial metallic object, such as one might buy in a market, but one of any number of curious, rather attractive, sometimes flattened, and usually almost circular stones that could easily be found in the quarries nearby. The farmers took these stones for granted, and why not? They were merely stones of a certain size, one of those very few conveniences of isolated rural life, to be given no more heed than one might give a clod of earth or a muddy pool. But William, who seems to have had a more curious eye than most, saw on the dairy scales objects that weren't ordinary at all. He looked carefully at each one of these stones, and realized that there were features about them that were uncommonly lovely, and had a meaning that no one else seems to have noticed, no one at the dairy at the very least. Some features of the pound stones were quite plain to see. Others required a closer look. When viewed from above, the stones appeared to be round, although, in fact, some of them weren't. Some had five sides, but sides that were sufficiently chamfered to give the stone, on cursory inspection, a circular appearance. Then again, all of the pound stones, whether they were actually round or five-sided, were about 4 inches across. In cross-section, the rounded ones were slightly flattened at the top and bottom, so that each stone would sit on the weighing scale without any inclination to roll off. The dairymaids obviously liked this feature, a weighing stone that would stay where it was put. But whether the stones were flat or indented, round or pentagonal, the Oxfordshire dairymaids found them useful also because they were remarkably uniform in both dimension and mass. Almost all of them weighed in at about 22 ounces, which just happened to be what the local dairy managers, in measuring out freshly churned butter for their customers, called a long pound. The five-sided variety was arranged in one of two general kinds of shape, each of which can best be imagined by thinking of an orange, either pressed down flat on a table, or else pressed down on top of a small pebble. Both, in other words, were rounded at the top, but some were totally flat below, while others had a shallow upward indentation at the base. Oxfordshire pound stones, which the locals still sometimes call Chedworth buns, are still to be found in the ploughed fields around Churchill. Close inspection of a good specimen reveals them to be even more complicated than one might suppose. The possession of five sides already suggests some degree of complexity, but in addition their outer surfaces are decorated with a series of quite beautiful filigrees of fine lines and beguiling, elegantly regular patterns. On the top of each rounded dome, for example, is a small disc composed of five leaf-like plates, which surrounds a tiny circular hole. Down what anyone fondling the stones will surely regard as their rather voluptuously convex sides, spread 10 ray-like arrangements of what seem to be plates, like armour. The plates are two sizes, large and small, and they are arranged so that one array of the smaller plates alternates with another of the wider plates, five times each. Underneath, at the point where these rays all come together again, like lines of longitude on a globe, there's another hole, quite larger than the one on top. and on some of the five-sided poundstones, but not on the totally round ones, there's a third hole, somewhat elongated and lozenge-shaped, which lies halfway down the curved exterior, right in the centre of one of the wider, large plate rays. Such things had actually first been recognised for what they were, or what they appeared to be, about a century before. It was in Sussex that a local naturalist, wondering about the version of Oxfordshire poundstones that he found in the fields near Brighton, realised that he had seen something very similar-looking that was actually living in the rock pools of his local seashore. Wedged into recesses of the pools, he had found scores of almost spherical animals, some of them round, some heart-shaped, all covered with sharp spikes. Sea urchins, he knew they were called. Their protective covering of spikes disguised the exoskeletons beneath. But once in a while, the naturalist would find on the beach a dead sea urchin, a specimen that had completely lost its spikes. Such a specimen, naked among the pebbles, displayed its eggshell-white exoskeleton perfectly. And this was the vital point of contact, for although the skeletons that were to be found on a Sussex beach were hollow and fragile and soap-bubble light, in shape and size and markings they were precisely the same as the solid, heavy stones he had found in the fields nearby. So this amateur scientist promptly deduced what we today would regard as perfectly obvious, that his poundstones were stones, yes, in that they were solid and made of what were evidently mineral materials, but they were also clearly the remains, or at least precise simulacra, of common sea urchins. They were members of the family known as echinoderms, and of the genus known as Echinus, both of which had been named after the Greek and Latin words from which we get urchin, which means hedgehog. The symmetry and beauty of the sea urchin-shaped stone that lay on the dairymaid's butter scales evidently caught the young William Smith's imagination. It's not too difficult to imagine him picking it up, turning it over and over in his hand, examining through a glass its intricate patterns of plates, striations, and whorls. He may well have compared it with pictures of modern sea urchins that he found in his textbooks in the village school, and asked questions of his teacher, an eccentric villager named Billy Watts, who seems to have taught his classes while sitting with a cat on each knee, and who probably wasn't the source of much enlightenment on the subject. And most crucially of all, young William may have asked himself questions that more disciplined scientists were even then beginning to puzzle over. Just what was a creature of the oceans doing, preserved, so strangely, as part of a rock? Just how did one solid become so firmly embedded inside another? Just what did such things, such weird phenomena, the encapsulation of objects from the sea deep inside the rocks of Oxfordshire, really mean? It was not long before another such object, just as prosaic and just as lovely, attracted his interest. Scattered all over the fields around Churchill, but of no interest to the dairymaids, were hundreds of small, thumbnail-sized objects, almost spherical, and with a vaguely opalescent sheen to them. They, too, had a subtle, magical beauty. On closer examination, when it was possible to see that their skins had an orange-peel-like texture, with thousands of tiny holes regularly arranged over their surface, their loveliness was even more apparent. They looked a little like acorns, or perhaps William, who might have been taken on school trips to some of the many Roman ruins with which Oxfordshire was littered, might have thought they looked a little like Roman oil lamps. The local farmers, who also spotted the similarity of shape, had long called them lamp shells. William called them pundibs, and in his diaries, written years later, he recalled using them as marbles to play games with his schoolmates. But like the sea urchins, these lamp-shell stones clearly had no logical place among the arid amassments of rock lying beneath the Oxfordshire fields. For these mimic creatures, if that's what they were, similarly belonged in the ocean. Contemporary living versions, which could also be found on shallow sloping sands beside the sea and in the estuaries of rivers, were composed of two small shells, the upper one slightly larger than and curving over the lower, with a small hole at the overlapping edge of the upper shell, from which a little gelatinous leg protruded to anchor the shell to the ground. Once in a while, when shallow seawater washed over the tiny animal, a most extraordinary thing happened. The two shells, which were evidently hinged close to the anchor leg, opened slightly, and from between them flicked a long, curled, rubbery, tongue-like organ, which waved among the suspended particles in the water, collected some of the edible morsels that stuck to its surfaces, and was then coiled back smartly between the shells, which promptly snapped shut. Following this lightning-quick feast, the animal then remained static, evidently digesting and nourishing itself on whatever its remarkable feeding limb had managed to collect. Today we know only too well exactly what the two objects were that the boy so admired and that so inspired him. The poundstone, an echinoid, was in all probability a species named Clypeus ploti, the genus name from the Latin, given because of its round shield-like shape, and its species name given in honour of a long-forgotten Oxfordshire geologist called Robert Plot. The marbles that William used in his schoolyard play were a type of brachiopod known as a pterobratulid, and most probably, given its roundness and its suitability for games, a small and pretty variety of pterobratulid known as Lobotharis. But all of this begs the original question. What were such sea creatures doing in the middle of a stretch of unenclosed pasture, 100 miles from the nearest shoreline, and, considering the height of the surrounding land above sea level, a good 300 vertical feet above it? To answer such questions today is quite simple. The shells are just fossils, once organic, but now mineralised relics of a time when the rocks that lie beneath the fields of Oxfordshire were themselves being created thousands of feet beneath a life-rich tropical sea. But in the late 18th century, no such theory had ever been even vaguely imagined. When William Smith was being entranced and captivated by the dairymaid's poundstones, nothing about fossils was simple, nothing was universally accepted, nothing was obvious at all. The entire notion of fossils, in fact, what they were, why they were where they were, what possible deeper meaning was signified by their existence, was quite profoundly different from anything that's imaginable today. When William Smith was growing up, everything about them, whether they were commonly found examples like brachiopods or echinoids, whether they were ammonites or trilobites, gastropods or graptolites, or teeth or ribs or fragments of coral, was seen in a very different light. Assumptions were made about them, and conclusions were drawn from their existence that bear little relation to what is today considered objective reality.